Podcast ain't played nobody. Ryan Nanny, I have a question for you right out of the gates here. I'm a good person, right? Just generally speaking, I mean, I seem to have purpose in life.
What universe are we, what's the sphere? Are we saying of all people, of media members, of college football media members, of Mizzou fans? Just can you tell me what circle we're talking about?
Well, not the last one for sure. Okay. Let's say any sports, like the sports writer sphere. Let's go with that.
You're great. You're a great person. Okay. You're like top 5%.
Sweet. I needed that affirmation because I spent my, sometimes I step back and wonder, what the hell are you doing? Because I spent, you know, a good portion of this morning writing about how basically defending Michigan and Jim Harbaugh. And getting a lot of pats on the back from Michigan fans for it. And sometimes it just feels weird. I'm not going to lie. And I basically did it all because I was prompted by a random – I live in a mostly Paul Feinbaum free universe. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of randomly stumbled into him talking about Jim Harbaugh not being able to win the big game. He might go back to the pros because this is a big failure or whatever. And it just pissed me off. And I started defending Michigan fans. And I don't like it.
I hate to go this way, but that's actually pretty brilliant of Paul Feinbaum, because there are two ways you can piss off a Michigan fan in respect to their current head coach. One, you can say he's a failure and that he hasn't finished above third in the division, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can sort of lay out the case that Jim Harbaugh is not good. And that will make them, I'm going to say, like 6 out of 10 mad. It doesn't make them fully mad because he's still theirs. He's still present. He's not Brady Hoke. And they are, I think they have a reasonable belief that better things are on the horizon and that the bad things can be explained away enough. That's item one.
Okay.
Item two is to say that Jim Harbaugh is going to go back to the pros. And you don't necessarily have to connect that to anything at Michigan. You can just make the case that he had a successful head coaching career as a pro before. He potentially would want to, the reason that ended had nothing to do with his skill as a coach, his relationship with his players. He just had like a bad front office relationship. And there are so many poorly coached NFL teams at this point that in theory, one will go after him. In other places, this would be seen as a compliment. Like if somebody said, you know, Dave Doran was being considered for an NFL job, like I think NC State fans would be like, whoa, that's like, damn, great job, Dave. At Michigan, it somehow makes them angrier than if you just say Jim Harbaugh sucks. So props to Paul Feinbaum, the troll king himself.
I was about to say, he's been doing this for like 40 years. I mean, he knows.
He knows the ins, the outs. He knows all the ways to make you uncomfortable and angry and sad.
And it made me uncomfortable, angry, and sad, and I'm not a Michigan fan.
So imagine how they're feeling. So it's good that Michigan fans have you, Bill, and I assume Godfrey's not here, but we all know the relationship between Michigan and Godfrey is stronger than ever.
That's great. Yeah, it's totally they love each other so much. That was just you step back and evaluate your life sometime and ask, how did you get here? And mine was going out of my way. I was unprompted, going out of my way to say, hey, Jim Harbaugh's doing okay, guys. It's fine.
What is the sort of best counter argument to that? What is the way in which Jim Harbaugh has not succeeded or has not lived up to expectations? Even if it doesn't indict his entire tenure at Michigan, what is the one area that you can point to and say, if only he could do that?
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, one of the things, and you know, injuries play a role in this, but his teams don't really get better as the season goes on. They're pretty much as good as they're going to be in September, and then they start to kind of just wither away a little bit. And again, I mean, last year, Whitland Speed had a bad performance, then got hurt and had another couple bad performances. This year, obviously, he's lost from the start. So, I mean, you can point to all that, but that's still like, that's something you don't like to see. Even with injuries, you like to see a team kind of rallying as the year goes on and performing pretty well at the end or whatever. And it has not happened. So yeah, that's, there's plenty of reason to like, there are plenty of reasons to critique Harbaugh. But we can't, like, I love the little picture stuff, and we go straight big picture. Anytime we're talking about a name like that, it's always big picture. Everything's a referendum, et cetera, et cetera. It kind of loses me pretty quickly.
And then you win a national championship, and then you're good for life. Except for life, unless you're Gene Chizik, in which case you're not. Sorry.
And this way, I think that would be interesting. If he does win a national title and then jumps to the NFL, I think that would be okay. I don't think anybody would really would jump off any bridges for that, because he came home and delivered to them what they had been lacking. And by the way, it is funny anytime, like, I, for whatever reason, I, maybe it's because I like getting, you know, page views. I've like defended Michigan a couple times this year. And, I almost had to remind myself last time I did it that they were a spot away from the college football playoff last year.
Right.
Like last year. And we're still like, that's when we have our jokes and our memes about, you know, never finish better than third and whatnot. And it's kind of fun. You know, we know all the needles for everybody. That's great. But then it becomes serious at some point. It like crosses over and becomes real instead of just a joke. And yeah, last year they were like an inch from the playoffs. So I think they're probably okay.
Yeah. I think this is the public service we should offer going forward. We'll set up like a P.O. box and we will tell fans in July, August, for your team and for maybe like four other teams that you're interested in, positively, negatively, whatever, write down your honest expectations at the start of the year, mail them into us, and we won't touch them until the end of the year. So then when you're all hot and bothered because Michigan finished, you know, 8-4, 9-3, we can go back and open your envelope and you're going to say Michigan's going to win 9 games. Be like, look, they did exactly what you thought. Why are you mad?
Yeah, that's also a hazard of being your best in September, because that completely causes you to reassess. Oh, wow, they're going to be better this year than I thought. They've done that 3 straight years, basically, end of like mid to late September. You're like, oh wow, they're further ahead than maybe I thought they were going to be. And then they end up not being ahead, and it pisses you off.
The alternative is that you keep Brett Bielema on for forever.
I'm staring at the possibility of my team losing to Brett Bielema this coming Friday.
You have to feel good about the overall progression of Missouri football.
Yeah, no, I don't want to lose to Arkansas, but I'm okay. They got the one they needed.
Right.
They're at 6th now. You know, it might make the difference between like Music City Bowl and Birmingham Bowl or something, which is a difference, by the way.
I agree. I agree.
I would go to one of those two.
Birmingham. Bill loves steel.
It's been 5 years and I'm still scarred by my one Birmingham traffic experience coming over here and going, oh my God. And not being able to move for the next hour and a half.
Yeah. But if it's the Music City Bowl, you're going to be contending with bachelorette parties.
I know how to maneuver Nashville though. I know where the good restaurants are, and that makes all the difference.
Okay.
Stay at that hotel with the guitar shaped pool and walk over to the stadium. Oh yeah. That's,
just stay with Godfrey. He'll enjoy it.
Yeah. I'm pretending. Yeah. Assuming he's back from his mission, but by the way, this is Podcast Ain't Played Nobody. I am Bill Connolly. I am the regular, host of the two of us right now. I'm sitting in for Stephen Godfrey as Ryan Nanny. Godfrey is still out on double secret mission, crossing, going coast to coast, getting coaches fired so that he can get his coaches installed into those big jobs. It's working pretty well so far, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, when Derek Dooley gets the Arkansas job, you'll know it was Godfrey. Godfrey made it happen.
Where is Derek Dooley, by the way? Is he still with like the Cowboys or something?
I think he's the wide receivers coach for the Cowboys. Okay. And there is no indication that he has any interest in being head coach in college football ever again. And I applaud him for it. Like, it's great that he sort of said, you know what? I'm happy here. This is good.
I really think, I mean, that's kind of the Tennessee effect to a certain degree. So let's see, we had Lane Kiffin, who was there for a year and went nope, and then Derek Dooley not only gets fired after 3 years but leaves college coaching entirely and hasn't come back since, and now Butch Jones, I guess, supposedly got contacted by Oregon State,
but and, it doesn't look like that's gonna happen,
and said nope. So you need a break after Tennessee. We are entering rivalry week. We are recording this on Tuesday. I appreciate Ryan coming on and helping me with this. I felt weird on Sunday. I just went solo. I figured I had enough to talk about and I was right, but I wasn't even going to pretend to do that for like the full on hour midweek show here. But we are recording on Tuesday so that everybody has PAPN downloaded and ready to go when you're driving to grandmother's house or whatever. What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
Oh, I am mixing things up this year. So I'm hosting my mother-in-law and a couple of cousins. There's going to be like six of us total, but I laid down the law, I don't know, in like June. I said, I'm not making Thanksgiving food this year. We're having Mexican food because I'd rather eat Mexican food. I don't feel like making a bunch of Thanksgiving food.
We did that for a number of years, actually. We, like, you know, Italy or Italian, and, or I think we did like a big Greek, what's the Greek lasagna thing called? God, the thing with like a bechamel on top and whatever.
Oh,
whatever it is. It's great. But I'm Googling Greek lasagna.
Greek lasagna cheese.
It is pastizio.
Okay.
Yeah, it was good. But yeah, we experimented. And then we had a kid who's learning about Thanksgiving and thinks that turkey is Thanksgiving. So now we go back to, we at least have smoked turkey, which I think is, you know, for leftovers purposes anyway, the best of the bunch. So we've kind of circled back.
I know I'll have to go there, but my kid is almost a year and a half. So she's not old enough to appreciate that or even know it's Thanksgiving or care about what's being given to her to shovel in her mouth as fast as she possibly can. So this is like my window to say this is what we're going to do. And I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. No, so yeah, that's a good menu. We did the same thing. I think we're almost taking Thanksgiving off this year. We've got a lot of stuff lined up in December, and the in-laws have a house they're desperately trying to finish fixing up so that they can sell their old house. They bought a farm, and so they're going to be laying tile. My parents are going to take the kid for an official Thanksgiving dinner. I'm going to try to kind of get the best of both worlds and help with the in-laws and eat my parents' food, and then come back and eat more with my wife at the very least in the evening. So I'm going to try to play it all, make it all a big win-win for me, but we'll see.
That's a jam-packed schedule. I really look forward to you describing on the next episode how it totally failed.
Oh, yeah, there's a chance I'm cereal for dinner. There's a very grave possibility of cereal for dinner, but I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay.
Remorse leading up to the Egg Bowl is, that feels right.
It feels very fitting. Yeah. It's all about bad choices, getting too big for your britches,
literally
making choices that didn't look to the future at all.
So let's. What we'll do here is we'll just dive straight into the schedule. We've gotten quite a few questions here, and I didn't really have any predetermined topics other than feeling gross about defending Michigan twice in a year. So let's just dive straight into the schedule and then kind of improvise as we go. Technically, Rivalry Week begins tonight, Tuesday, November 21st, when Bowling Green and Eastern Michigan, Kent State and Akron, and Miami, Ohio, and Ball State all play each other for kind of the Maction finale, I guess you could call it. Akron's pretty good.
Akron's pretty good. Eastern, at least, has been feistier this year than they have in previous years.
Very creative in the way they've gone about losing close games, yeah.
So that's an advantage. This is a hard sell, especially because whether you're doing Mexican Thanksgiving, regular Thanksgiving, whatever, Tuesday's got to be a prep day, right?
Yeah, we've already – my wife is making dressing as we speak. I don't know what – I think the turkey's up on deck tonight, yeah.
So this is – maybe this is your good, like, background noise game where you just sort of – you have Kent State Akron. You just sort of say, like, that's going to be on and I'll be able to hear it, but I'm not going to dedicate any focused attention to this. And I don't think they'll be mad at that.
No, that's what they're for. I think that's the slogan at this point. Maction, hey, you need background noise. I'm still pissed at Akron for ruining what I thought would be a pretty good Ohio-Toledo MAC title game. So if Kent State wanted to somehow upset Akron tonight, that'd be awesome. It's not gonna. Kent State's horrific, so it's not going to happen. But that's really the one hope I've got leading into this. So we'll move straight on to Thursday. According to LSUfootball.net, by the way, there are two college football games on Thursday. Yes, the Egg Bowl is at night, but first, you can watch live on BamaStateSports.com. Edward Waters plays at Alabama State. I couldn't even make a joke about who you got between the like and list out the nicknames because I have no idea what Edward Waters is exactly.
I'm looking it up on Wikipedia right now because I refuse to pretend that I have this level of knowledge myself. It's a private college in Jacksonville and the oldest HBCU in Florida.
Okay.
It has 800 students.
Oh.
So
and at least 11 of them will be on a football field on Thursday afternoon, on the middle of Thursday afternoon. Like, when are you supposed to eat at that point? I mean, that's
Think how hungry you'll be though after that game if you're playing in it.
Yeah. Hornets at Tigers, Tigers at Hornets. That's right. The matchup. But the big one, of course, is the Egg Bowl, which is back on Thanksgiving, and that's all lovely and everything. Ole Miss has neither thrived nor collapsed. I kind of thought it was going to go hard one way or the other. And instead they've just been pretty decent, and that's really disappointing. They blew that Arkansas game, but then they turned right back around, beat Kentucky at the last minute, walloped ULF Lafayette, put up at least a pretty good fight against A&M, even though they lost. Mississippi State, meanwhile, kind of tried to lay an egg last week. So this is me trying to talk myself into maybe the game being interesting and Mississippi State not just running away with it, but I don't know. I was hoping for top 20 or bottom 20 from Ole Miss this year.
Yeah, I mean, they were a non-factor in the SEC West. They've lost all of their games in that part of the division. They did win their two East games against they killed Vandy, and they beat Kentucky. Other than that, I mean, yeah, it's been fine. It's a year that I think is probably a good reflection on the coaches that are still at Ole Miss, that they sort of kept things relatively together. And they never look like, by and large, this team didn't look a total mess over the course of the season. You probably get some credit for that, where you just get, it's one of those seasons where it's just like, listen, I know we moved into this house and it's got rats and bed bugs and half of it's on fire, but I managed to serve lunch. I should get credit for that. It doesn't matter if it was a good lunch, it was lunch.
I guess that was the what Godfrey unearthed about this time last year, I believe, about Matt Luke staying at Ole Miss as opposed to going, I think it was South Carolina, that he stayed there because he knew, you know, he was basically promised the interim coach job if something wild happened, and there was a very good chance that something wild was going to happen. Not necessarily the way it played out. That part was a little creative, but we kind of, you know, it was pretty obvious that the odds were good there. And I mean, I would assume then he's not going to get the full-time job, I'm assuming, but I would guess that he got out of the experience what he wanted to get out of it. They are, you know, 5-6. It could have been way worse. Could have been better. A couple of close losses in there. The Arkansas game really was just a hilariously unlikely turn of events. But they've been okay. And I would assume that, you know, that will reflect well on him when we think about just how crazy this could have been.
Yeah, I think that all seems right. Also, Egg Bowl, either way, is just has the best stories, I think, of any rivalry. My personal favorite is in like the early 1900s, head coach Frank Mason, I think the game, either Ole Miss was losing or it was tied at halftime. So he brought out a coffee urn that had whiskey in it as well, so that he could warm the players up. And Ole Miss lost 15-0. And he basically like quit the team after that. Like, they asked him afterwards if the team was going to go home that night, because I guess it was kind of late. And he was like, yep. They're going north, and I'm going somewhere else, and I hope I never see them again. And he didn't. That was his last game as head coach. It's the best. It's one of the most hilarious ways to go out.
I mean, we'll see if Matt Luke has something similar in mind. He could. I mean, this is a perfect opportunity for it, but I doubt that one's going to be topped. Oh, hell, Dan Mullen, you know, he's the prototypical interested in every job guy. So technically, either way, we could get that, but guess probably not.
Props.
Friday. We'll just move straight on to Friday after that wonderful main course of Ole Miss, Mississippi State. We get some more impactful football, I'll call it. The morning shift. This is good. Like, last week I felt bad about asking Bud, like, usually when Godfrey and I do this, we're like, hey, which game are you going to pick for this session? And they were all so bad, we didn't do it. But this week I feel like we can make picks here. It starts early. It starts 10:30 Central Time on Friday with Western Michigan Toledo, a game that I don't believe really has any importance whatsoever, since Toledo's not going to get the G5 Bowl, and they're probably going to win. I think they've already wrapped up the MAC. Which one is that? East. Anyway, but regardless, if you're interested in watching football before lunch, you've got that. But then at 11 a.m. Central Time on FS1, we've got Baylor at TCU, which allowed me to reminisce about the 2011 and 2014 Baylor TCU games. It's already served its purpose. I don't need to watch that one. Miami at Pitt on ABC, where Miami once again flirts with the idea of losing to a relatively bad team, and then turns around and beats Clemson by 38 next week. You've got Navy at Houston, 11 on ESPN. You've got NIU at Central Michigan at 11 on CBS Sports. And really, you've got the main event of the day, Missouri at Arkansas, 1:30 on CBS.
Sure,
the Carter Blackburn game. So of those, which one catches your eye?
I guess you're right. It has to be Miami at Pitt. Like, this Pitt team is not bowl eligible, has not been great this season. Not abjectly terrible or anything like that, but they've shown flashes of competence and talent. They went toe to toe with Virginia Tech. They probably should have beaten Virginia Tech, but they didn't. And Miami likes to use exactly as much fuel as they need to win the race. Like, they don't want to lap you. They don't want to, win by 8 lengths. They just want to make sure that they're ahead at the finish line. So this absolutely has the potential to be something where you look up and you're like, oh shit, Pitt's up by 18 at halftime and Miami still wins by 12.
Our friend Brody Logan at Brody Logan asks, has Miami made the Snoop Dogg career flip where he went from hated by everyone but his own fans to now doing shows with Martha Stewart? Seems like everyone likes the Canes now. This is true. They are no longer the villain of college football. And I mean, I'm sure you can find some people who will grumble about the turnover chain if you really, really want to, but you can find anything if you look for it on the internet. Overall, there is no hero versus villain. It's just, hey man, this is great. Welcome back to the party.
Yeah. I mean, they have the halo, both literal and figurative, of Mark Richt that I think sort of protects them and insulates from the sensibilities of, oh, he's a nice, he's, let's agree that Mark Richt is definitely not Jimmy Johnson. Does that seem fair?
You could probably get away with that.
Probably infer that. Although now you're imagining Mark Richt doing a boner pill commercial and you're very confused, and I'm sorry for that. Yeah, I think for now that's true, but I wonder how long it's going to last, because this is not at all a one-to-one comparison, but that's the position the Golden State Warriors were in when they made their first finals run. Everybody was like, oh shit, this like hard scrabble team that nobody knew about and everybody thought this franchise was like perpetually dead and morose, out of nowhere they're world beaters and they can do all this cool shit. And now it feels like everybody hates the Warriors and everybody is just like, nah, screw them. So it's good for Miami now. I would not count on it lasting even into next season, really.
Yeah, and really, if you want a kind of a general impression, if you feel like you're feeling too good about Miami and you want to kind of tamp those feelings down, just go and interact with Miami fans on Twitter for a little bit.
Here's what I will say. I am proud that their shit-talking muscles did not atrophy.
No. Like, and what's funny is they've just shifted, because until this season, basically what they would talk about in any sort of, reverential, how dare, like, well, I wrote a book called 50 Best College Football Teams of All Time, and we know that the best is not the best. It was really kind of a terrible title if you think about it, but buy my book. In the process, though, anytime a Miami fan ever came across the title, they would at me immediately and say, 2001 Miami better be number one.
Right.
But this year they've finally been able to flip the switch and they beat Florida State and they're undefeated. They've got all this adoration coming their way. And so they're able to talk about the present tense now, and that has to feel pretty good.
Yeah. I think it's much more fulfilling for them, which is great. Good for you, Miami.
Yeah, sure. Another question about this time slot from our friend, M Turkey at ELMK. If TCU beats Baylor and plays OU in the Big 12 championship, what can the Frogs do to ensure crotch grab 2.0, crotch #crotchwatch17. The only thing I'm going to say about Crotch Watch, I went out of my way not to write about it this week. I think the rest of our college team handled it just fine. The one thing I will say is Kansas got exactly what they wanted there. Exactly. They wanted to get into his head and have him thinking about something other than playing good football. And they didn't play good football for most of the first half. And then at the end of the game, like, granted, there were some cheap shots. It wasn't just the handshake thing. I mean, the cheap shots were kind of a bigger deal to me than the handshake. And then at the end of the game, it was clear that it was still in his head. So they did what they wanted. They're just terrible. And they couldn't actually use that to accomplish anything close to a win. They were just, they're too bad to pull that off, but they still, that one thing, they actually, I think, did what they wanted to do and got to do what they wanted to do.
See, I think TCU needs to practice sort of emotional whiplash here. And if they face, if they do successfully make it to the Big 12 championship game and face Oklahoma, I think then you go like aggressively complimentary pregame handshake. You're like, Baker, how do you get your hair to do? It just like, it always looks good. Helmet on, helmet off, whatever. Like, it just got this natural body and shine, and just like really make him be like, man, they were talking about my hair a lot. And then he's distracted. Yeah. He's distracted in a totally different way, and you won't look like a dick.
That's right. And he's not going to grab his crotch. And by the way, God bless ESPN for blurring that. making it actually look like he whipped something out in the middle of the game. That was just beautiful. Made it seem so much better and worse than it actually was at the same time. Another question about Bear. We're loading up on the early questions here. At Matt is Bear on Twitter says, I will make the transition to PAPN exclusively if you buy Baylor football stock publicly. Sorry.
Well, hold on. You can hold on to like this. Well, yes, right. Okay, sure. You know, you buy the whole principle is buy low, sell high. Yes, there are actually lower times to buy Baylor stock, but still pretty low. It's still pretty affordable. I don't know. I feel like I could get on board with this.
Okay. All right, that's fine. As long as somebody else went first, I can do it too. I do like Matt Rule.
All I do is make bad predictions and bad decisions. Perfect.
Just draw cover for others. Yeah, no, we're Matt Rule fans on PAPN. Sure. And technically, you know, all the stock has to do is improve like a hair for it to have technically been an okay investment. So sure.
Do they play Liberty in 2018?
I'm assuming. let's see.
As long as they don't, I feel good about it. If they do,
Let's see. 2018 Baylor schedule includes Abilene Christian at UTSA and then Duke at home. So basically the same as this year, except flip the home and home and trade Liberty for or trade Abilene Christian in for Liberty.
Yeah, you know what? It's so low right now. I'll absolutely say all I have to do for this stock to pay off is what? Baylor has to win two games next year? And I'm golden. My stock doubled in value. Absolutely.
They made their one win count. That was my favorite part. Michigan was the headliner of Numerical today, but my favorite little tidbit was going back and looking up for the last 10 years, the teams that only won one game, how much did they win that game by? Because, you know, Georgia Southern suddenly coming out of nowhere to win a game by 52, which I think it activated a clause in Joey Jones's poor Joey Jones's contract at South Alabama. Like, well, you have to resign now. you just lost by 50 to a winless team. You have to resign.
You'll see section C, subsection 3, lowercase b, resignation for shame. Yeah, it's right in there.
But that was a shame because until then, Baylor's win over Kansas this year, 30 something points, was the biggest of your congratulations. Your one win of the year was really big. They would have been the award winners there, but Georgia Southern went South Alabama went and did what they did, to ruin that for them. So that's a shame. Moving on to the afternoon slate. And I was talking about, this is a good slate. The afternoon slate is basically two games. You've got, if you really want to watch New Mexico at San Diego State, 2:30 on CBS Sports, you can. I would point out that New Mexico has completely bottomed out and San Diego State's actually pretty good now. So don't, but if you want to, that's fine. 2:30, you've got, I kind of love and hate that this is the game at 2:30, but you've got South Florida at UCF on ABC. prime real estate there for UCF to show off and not screw around. South Florida, by the way, has kind of not been very good for the last month. And then at 3 o'clock, you've got Iowa at Nebraska. So on FS1. So with Iowa, Nebraska, how does Nebraska choose to send nice old Mike Riley off into the sunset? Do they put up a fight? Because Iowa seems to have stopped fighting to some degree. They seem to be very set on making the win over Ohio State look even weirder than it seemed when it happened. And Nebraska gave up 400 something yards to Minnesota a couple of weeks ago. So which resistible force or movable object here wins out?
You know, I think you pull back into the Mike Riley Nebraska archives. Granted, they're not long. You don't even need a full file cabinet to get through them. But I think you go right for that. I believe it was the year one vibe was Nebraska loses close game at the end because of dumb decision. Yeah. I think you do that. I think you have something where, you know, you decide to kick a field goal when you're down four and you're at the Iowa 17, and then you just never get the ball back. Like it feels okay. Like this is where you sort of say, ah, this was what made the Mike Riley experience so miserable at the start. Let's sort of do a trip down memory lane and revisit that.
And that seems like a very Iowa way to win as well. So you kind of, you know, cross two boxes.
Oh yeah. Kirk Ferentz would respect the hell out of it.
Garrett Schramm at G Schramm 15 asks, which hire was worse, Bill Callahan or Mike Riley? Mike Riley.
Really?
To me. Yes. Callahan, the problem with Callahan was that they fired Solich to begin with.
Right.
That was kind of the start of them like really kind of losing their identity, losing themselves, not really being able to figure out what they wanted or who they were. And Callahan won a Big 12 North title and, had like a couple of decent seasons, obviously didn't do enough. And, he left the cupboard relatively stocked among other things, he signed Ndamukong Suh, which was very nice for his successor to have. But that was, at the very least, you know, there was unique thought behind it. Mike Riley was basically, hey, he's nice. I think Nebraska fans would like a nice guy for change. And that was it. That was the only rationale for hiring Mike Riley. And that's terrible. And it did happen so quickly that I actually remember what I wrote when he was hired. And since I'm frequently wrong, as everybody else is about in coach hire grades, I can legitimately say this was really, really dumb to me from the start. I'm not happy that it failed because Mike Riley is a nice guy. And so is his offensive coordinator, Langsdorf, for that matter. But it was just not a good thought process at all.
Yeah, I guess I was tilting Callahan just because letting go of Solich and seeing what he has done on his protracted revenge tour at Ohio sort of stands in stark contrast to what the circumstances of Mike Riley entering. But I guess that's fair. It's you know, Godfrey and I wrote about probably like a month ago, if you're an Arkansas fan, what's the peak of the Brett Bielema, Brett Bielema's tenure there? I have no idea what the peak of Nebraska's Mike Riley's years are. Like, I honestly can't remember one game where you were like, oh, what an awesome moment.
Right. Even when they had a better record last year, it was just a reverse of the year before where they were winning close games.
Right. Because somebody else made a stupid decision.
Right. Yeah. Bielema at least like stomped Texas and stomped LSU. Like he would at least have a couple moments where like, yeah, that was the vision right there. I don't know what the vision was for Nebraska. It is funny though, thinking back to Callahan, like, so the last time I was in Lincoln, I went up there. I got a press pass at the last second in 2010 for the last Missouri Nebraska game. And I remember the guy I was with, he went to pick up the passes and I was sitting in the car and it was on whatever Lincoln. It was pregame radio of whatever kind with whichever Makavica happened to be on the radio at that point. And they were talking about the Missouri series and how I don't remember the wording exactly, but he was just talking about like, and yeah, and then Solich, I mean, everything fell apart at the end of the Solich era. And then a pause. And we, of course, don't count anything that happened under Callahan. But then in with Pelini in 09, it just like just 04 to 0, even Pelini's first year, 08, didn't actually happen. It was like It's history stopped when they lost the national title game in 01 and then started again in 09. And now I would like to hear what random Makovicka brother says on the radio now, because history is getting awfully awkward in Lincoln in terms of what does count and what doesn't.
It's so I'm going to use a raw number here, which I know you're going to hate.
Okay.
But identity is obviously an important factor at a number of institutions. Florida, you know, has its own obsession with offense, and defenses are important to Husker fans. Mm-hmm. Nebraska this season has given up 381 points. Granted, you know, that's not opponent adjusted. That doesn't tell you where those points came from.
It's a lot, though.
It's a lot, and it's more than anybody else in the Big Ten. Maryland, 379. Rutgers, 300. Illinois, 336. And that's, I think, what it ultimately comes down to, is that you're just like, listen, maybe you're not going to bring Nebraska back to the heights of defense that they think that they should be. But this is so far. This is like, we can't even see the mountain at this point. We're turned the other direction and we're face down in a lake.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing about what's happening now, too, is that with what Godfrey reported from his bunker a few days ago about Nebraska at least kicking the tires on some option names, that's just mean. Don't do that to your fan base. Don't do that to me. Like, if they hired Ken Niumatalolo, I would buy a Nebraska shirt. I'm legally required to still dislike Nebraska because of the diploma on the wall, but I would buy a Nebraska shirt if you hire Ken Niumatalolo, because, oh my God, that would be spectacular. And I really do want to see what Niu would actually do, like with a budget he could go spend like on some potentially really nice defensive coaches, and you know, slash recruiters. I'm really curious how that would all operate or what he would choose to do. But don't tease. If you're going to do that and then hire, you know, Jim McElwain or somebody very similar to that, like the Jed Fish type, I think that's who we saw tied to Oregon State today. That's just mean. That's not, that's going to be such a letdown. let's see. So that was, UCF. I think I got some UCF questions here. Let me see. So of all the questions we got a few associated with the Outback Bowl. And we got more than one that started with, as a Tampa native. So this is a new experience for me. I'm not going to I don't think this is something Godfrey and I are going to deal with whenever he chooses to come back or is able to come back. But Dakota Moyer at Dak Moyer asks, as a Tampa native, how does Ryan feel about the fact that USF and UCF are good and UF and FSU are glorious tire fires? I don't know. Have you talked about this at all? Not
in great detail, to be honest. Like, I think it's well established at this point that I am so desensitized to all Florida failure and misadventure that, like, that doesn't mean anything to me. It is nice that Florida State is also bad, so I don't feel like I'm, you know, like Florida is alone in this. And it's, you know, UCF and USF being good right now are mostly palatable because they're not out of nowhere. Both of these programs are where they are because they have coaches who have built something, maybe in a relatively short amount of time, but they're either benefiting from what their predecessors did or they have a recent history of success that they're sort of trading in on. If anything, it's kind of encouraging because it's like, well, shit, the assholes in Orlando can do it. Surely Florida can fix this. That said, I don't know if that's actually true. It's actually much harder to consider that FAU and FIU are also seem to be in a much better position, seem to be making much more progress than Florida and Florida State did. That's the part that's UCF and USF. Listen, those are teams that have won double digit games. In UCF's case, went to a BCS bowl. In USF's case, you know, had a great season last year. FAU, FIU, oh, really? Really? Even they're better than Florida? That's hard. But Florida didn't reschedule its hurricane game just to try to sneak into bowl eligibility. So we have that honor.
and poor ULM. Well, actually, maybe poor Florida State. I'm not sure.
I believe Monroe potentially needs that game for bowl eligibility themselves.
I think that's how that's going to work, or come close to it or something. But what's going to be funny is if Florida State loses to Florida, what, like, you still now have to play ULM. Yeah. Like, you rescheduled the game just in case. But if you lose to Florida, and Florida actually seemed to want to play last week, which was kind of different than the previous few weeks. And so, yeah, if Florida State beats them, they still now have to go home and play a ULM with a roster, like, just basically play all your freshmen and sophomores at that point, because everybody else will have completely checked out. Yeah. Including, hey, you know, maybe the coach. So we move on to Friday evening. We've got the aforementioned Florida International hosting Western Kentucky at 6 p.m. Central on BN. I mean, if there's nothing else on for an hour, go for it. But then you've got Virginia Tech at Virginia at 7 p.m. on ESPN. You've got Texas Tech at Texas at 7 p.m. on Fox. And you've got California at UCLA at 9:30 p.m. on FS1. What is Texas Tech's record right now?
They're 5-6, 2-6 in conference.
Yeah, they've been. I feel bad for Kingsbury because I think they're legitimately better this year than they were last year. But then you start going through their, you know, 41-34 loss to Oklahoma State, 46-35 where they blew a huge lead against West Virginia. They were really in position against Oklahoma and then fell apart late. They fell apart in the third quarter, and then Oklahoma almost literally played keep away in the fourth quarter, and they could never get the ball back for like the last 10 minutes. Kansas State, they lost 42-35. They've been really close to a kind of, I don't want to say breakthrough, but at least a nice rebound season. And instead they're stuck in this limbo of, well, can we do better? Do we fire Cliff? Do we give him another year? Is anything going to change? And I don't know if anything will change. I don't know what you do if you're Texas Tech.
Right. What do their defensive numbers look like on your end?
Technically better. They're up to 91st in defensive S&P Plus.
That's not, I mean, 91st is still bad, but considering where this team was the last two, three seasons, like.
And I mean, they did, I mean, they lose Mahomes, they had a reset on offense, and they only fell to 25th, or have only fallen to 25th. Texas has a pretty good defense, so I mean, we'll see. But and last week's, I mean, they lost 27-3 to TCU, despite, I believe, outgaining TCU. It's just one of those stupid, we're going to get to the 10 and then figure out how to, you know, pee down our leg differently every single possession. But they, I don't know. Like, there has been, I think, improvement on defense. There's reason to assume that, you know, as the pieces come back together again, I mean, I guess you lose Szymanek and you lose Dylan Cantrell, but I mean, you're never going to worry that much about the Tech offense, and the defense has almost no seniors. You could kind of talk yourself into giving Cliff another last chance.
Yeah. It seems like it seems like it would be just a weird year to blow it up. I mean, the progress has been slow but steady. They have been in games against better competition where previously they just usually weren't in them at all. And, you know, it's the defensive number. The fact that they are at least showing progress and at least getting to the point where it's like, okay, if we can just jump up to like the 70s next year, that probably puts them in position, if they can make a little progress on offense as well, to win 8 games. Potentially next season?
Potentially. I mean, the Big 12 is just such a mess where, like, you can easily get to 8 games, but somebody has to lose those games, and everybody's, like, exactly the same.
Yeah, so I feel like it would be – Cliff Kingsbury came into the year as the Big 12 coach it felt like was most likely to be handed his papers. It just doesn't seem like what he's done would justify it at this point, especially because you look and it's like, where's the worst loss? Where's the loss that is like totally unacceptable? Maybe it's Kansas State. Even Iowa State, you know, at this point, you can't say that that's terrible. So because you can't point to anything and say, like, this is the game that we expected you to win and you didn't, and you still got 5 wins. And if he beats Texas, it's fine. Either way, 5-7 with this team and where they where they've come from, I feel like that should be enough.
But I wrote a big like semi-history piece this morning. I'm not sure when it's going to go up for sure, but I love being able to, like, one of the biggest, the most momentous things that Texas Tech has ever been involved in college football history, besides the Michael Crabtree touchdown against Texas, was the fact that in 1968, they stomped Texas so badly that Texas finally gave up on its former blue chip quarterback, Bill Bradley, and went with this little no name James Street, who then won like 30 something games in a row as quarterback and like mastered the wishbone, which caused Alabama to adopt the wishbone and Oklahoma to adopt the wishbone, and basically kind of changed college football, all because it was completely and totally unacceptable to get stomped at Texas Tech.
And that's why Texas Tech is the most important program in college football history.
Pretty much.
That's what Bill just
butterfly
said.
Butterfly effect right there. Yeah, butterfly. Yep. And then the final game that night is California at UCLA. We kind of – it's anticlimactic because Moore's already been fired. They didn't wait till after the season. They wanted to make sure to fire him on his birthday. I feel bad talking to a Florida fan about this, because I really want Chip Kelly to go to UCLA.
That's fine. I don't think that's unreasonable.
I think he won't. I'm assuming he ends up at Florida when all of this plays out. But I guess, you know, just from the perspective of like, UCLA is one of those schools that we always talk about potential and we never really get to talk about the present tense. Right. And more for a little bit, it looked like maybe he was, you know, he had a couple of legitimately strong seasons there. And the recruiting was such that you could kind of say, okay, here we go. Here's where we find out what their ceiling is. And then he, you know, the offense completely falls apart one year because he hired a first time offensive coordinator who just said the word multiple a lot. And then, you know, the offense turns around this year and the defense completely and utterly falls apart, and that was it. And you know, he lectures, you know, his quarterback about what hats he wears and you know, does all that crap too. But I guess if Kelly doesn't go, what is kind of the best case scenario for you at UCLA? Who might be able to tap into whatever the ceiling is there?
I am a little surprised, and maybe you can speak to this more intelligently than I can, which is a very low bar. Congratulations. I'm a little surprised that Scott Frost has not been talked about for this job at all. Yeah. But mostly because I think people have said, well, his alma mater's open. There is some weird domino effect where Oregon, his most recent stop, would be available. There's a big job in state that's available. But UCLA does – I don't know. It feels like maybe that is one that should be on the potential radar. It would be nice for UCLA to finally hire like an up-and-comer and not somebody who failed and washed out somewhere else. And I'm not – that's not really shade at Chip Kelly, but it is a matter of like, when was the last UCLA hire that you could say like, oh, they like snagged this guy who's on the way up through the coaching ranks? It's been a long time. It's been a very long time. So I'm a little – there might be a good reason that you can tell me why he's just not in the mix for that at all. Maybe he just isn't interested.
Yeah. Yesterday when the rumor came out, this felt like a bot almost. It wasn't. It came from a similar, I don't remember who it was, but similarly legitimate source on Twitter saying that UCLA had at least internally kicked the tires on Jeff Fisher.
Yeah.
I mean... This was like when I got mad at Randy Shannon for kicking a field goal on 4th-and-1, even though I was rooting for the other team. It's like, I don't have any investment in UCLA, but come on. Come on. That's the most generically UCLA hire I can think of. Like, don't do that.
Maybe this is UCLA's way of sort of spreading that out into the atmosphere amongst their fans so that when they hire anyone who's not Jeff Fisher, success.
Yeah, that's right.
Bullet dodged.
Yeah, and for a long – like I'm looking back now through like UCLA's hires. For a long time, they had kind of an up-and-comer thing. Like Tommy Prothro wasn't extremely young when they hired him, but it was basically, hey, that guy's kicking butt at Oregon State. Right. Let's bring him on. And he immediately went to a Rose Bowl, got a Heisman for Gary Beeben, like probably would have done really good things had he not jumped to, I believe, the Rams, if I remember right. But then they brought in Pepper Rogers, who was a Prothro assistant, and he had a couple good years and then left for like Georgia Tech or something like that. Then they hired Dick Vermeil, who left for the Eagles. And then they hired Terry Donahue, who I think qualified as an up-and-comer still. He was like in his 30s or whatever. And he stayed there for whatever, 20 years. But yeah, since then, Bob Toledo, Carl Durrell, Rick Neuheisel, Jim Mora.
It's not great. So
young energy.
I'm actually more interested in the Cal side of this game, though, to be honest.
Yeah.
No, Cal is not going to finish even top three in the Pac-12 North, but the season they've had in 1 year under, you know, we talk about what Texas Tech did this year after, you know, however long we are into Cliff's time there. Yeah. This 1 year turnaround for Cal even if they don't go to a bowl game, I think is wildly impressive. I think the fact that they're able to beat two Power Five schools out of conference. Granted, UNC's not very good, but as we said before, Ole Miss is not like a total shell of itself.
And UNC at that point in the year hadn't suffered like 38 injuries yet. Yeah. So they're a decent UNC.
Yeah, I mean, the Wazoo game, obviously. And even some of the losses, you know, you look big game last week. They went sort of toe-to-toe with a Stanford squad that, while is not the best Stanford team we've ever seen, is a quality opponent. They hung with USC. They didn't hang with Washington, but that's like all in all. And the fact that they're able to play some competent defense in some of these games, not all of them overall, I think it's very promising. And it's a good sign that like Cal went out, found somebody who was not the biggest name on the market last year, who was, they were taking a little bit of a chance on, and it's paid off for them, at least in year one.
Yeah, I think the most impressive thing about their year to me is that they've completely collapsed on two separate occasions and then rebounded.
Right.
Like they, you know, started 3-0, fought pretty well against USC, got stomped by Oregon, got really stomped by Washington, turned right around and throttled Washington State out of nowhere, then almost beat Arizona when Khalil Tate was unstoppable, and then got stomped by Colorado. But then came right back around and beat Oregon State, almost beat Stanford. So, I mean, they're resilient. Whatever credit you do or don't want to give them, like they've been resilient as hell, and good for them for that.
Yeah.
And then Saturday, after UCLA rounds out the evening, we got Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Central. We pick right back up with a boatload of games. I almost wish that there were more Friday games. You know, it's nice to be able to focus on UCF, and of course it's nice to be able to focus on Missouri always. But yeah, it's still a little overloaded. We need to go 50-50 balance here. Regardless, 11 a.m. Central Time, East Carolina at Memphis on ESPNU, Florida State at Florida on ESPN, Georgia at Georgia Tech on ABC, Indiana at Purdue on ESPN2, Kansas at Oklahoma State on FS1. We've got the FCS playoffs beginning with a couple of early games. Lehigh at Stony Brook on ESPN Extra. Louisville at Kentucky on SEC Network. Ohio State at Michigan on Fox. Tulane at SMU on CBS Sports. UConn at Cincinnati on ESPN News. And then at 11:20 Central on the ACC Network oddity little slot, whatever channel you've got that on. Boston College at Syracuse. Duke at Wake Forest on some other channel, FSN affiliates at 11:30, and we'll stop there.
Yeah, the BC Syracuse game is going to be on the channel. You're like, they have college football? Cooking channel has college football games, huh? Okay, cool.
I get those games, but not in HD. It's like in blurry standard def.
Right. Right. Why does the TV Guide channel have the Boston College game on? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a hell of a TV deal they've got, but I'm going to miss it when they actually get a real like arrangement, whenever that is, 2027 or something like that.
True.
So the one thing here, before I look at the questions that we've gotten, the one thing here, as I put together this big piece about rivalry history and stuff, Georgia Tech, clean old fashioned hate, I've decided, is the most underrated rivalry in college football when it comes to the actual quality and oddity of the game itself.
Sell me on that.
Okay. So first of all, like every freaking game is decided within a touchdown in the final score. I think basically, let me see here. Let me pull up the notes that I took earlier. We've got 10 of the last 13 games have been decided by one possession. That despite the fact that, you know, yes, Georgia Tech's been pretty good a few times, but Georgia's usually better. You know, one team is usually quite a bit better than the other in this rivalry. Every game comes down to 3 or 6 or 7 or overtime or something like that. So you've got that. You've got the awesome rivalry name. Clean old fashioned hate. You've got it's a very neighbor rivalry, which I'm very used to with the Missouri Kansas thing and you know Kansas City and whatnot. I think it's got a lot going for it, despite the fact that I think Georgia fans hate playing this game. Part of that is because it's close every year, but it's an annoyance to them, which really kind of makes me happy.
Yeah, I think I don't know if they hate it. I think they have the requisite amount of Georgia fear because Georgia fans live in perpetual fear of everything going wrong at all times. That is why the most natural Georgia career is insurance agent. But I think they actually like look forward to the opportunity to win this, because they do win this game more often than not. I mean, you have to go back to 98 to 2000 to find a Georgia Tech winning streak. And you can find a lot of games in here where Georgia has come out on top, especially for like realistically the last 40 years or so. Yeah. So I think they unlike, you know, Georgia, Florida or Georgia Auburn, it doesn't have the sort of like, we lose this game more often than we would like to. It's super frustrating. It also doesn't, it usually doesn't wreck Georgia's season one way or the other. That's the nice thing about it, is that it's already, you know, they're done with conference play. And by the time this game usually rolls around, it's just a matter of like, which January bowl are you going to go to?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't wreck national title hopes.
Right. Which, oh, wait, this is the year it could. Congratulations, everyone.
That was a nice jinx attempt, I will say. Yeah. But kind of blatant, actually. It's kind of clumsy. I will, for this piece that will go up at some point that I've teased a couple of times, I did reference the 99 Georgia-Georgia Tech game, which is probably my favorite. And not only because I'm always a fan of the underdog, but... the summary of that game is that A, Georgia was down 17 points in the second half. B, they came all the way back. I believe, let's see, they came all the way back, took the lead. Georgia Tech made a field goal to tie it. At the end of regulation with 9 seconds left, Jasper Sanks of Georgia was called for a fumble at the 2-yard line and Tech recovered. On replay, he was very much down before the ball came loose. And then in overtime, Georgia Tech has a field goal. So Georgia misses a field goal. Tech has a chance to win the game. It's blocked, but something, there's like a scramble. It gets touched or something like that. And Georgia Tech recovers and then makes the field goal to win the game on like the next play. A lot going on there. And that was Joe Hamilton, which is, you know, my favorite Georgia Tech teams anyway, pretty much. And so, yeah, we oddities and the crowd rushes the field. It was great. That's one of the games I remember a lot of, even though I don't completely remember the scramble that happened for that field goal.
Is this the most perplexing Georgia Tech team you can remember? Cause I have no meaningful read on a team that has like, you know, beat Virginia Tech, beat a decent Wake Forest team, but also lost to Virginia, lost by 23 to Duke. Like lost to a bad Tennessee team in sloppy, stupid fashion.
That was, first of all, that's one of those week one games where you look back on it and go, oh yeah, no, that wasn't an encouraging sign for Georgia Tech to only lose by 1 point to Tennessee on a neutral field. Yeah, we were talking about Cal collapsing and recovering. This is really, Tech just seems tired. Like they seem to have just kind of, they're just getting by. And I mean, Paul Johnson, I guess, always seems tired. But you have the Tennessee game that looks a lot different. You have the 1 point loss to Miami, which seems a lot different since they've continued to win. But then the North Carolina, easily beating North Carolina and Pitt, looks a lot different. And really it comes down to the last 2 weeks being super weird, beating Virginia Tech. I posted this on Twitter last night. I love the Duke rationale. Duke comes out, basically plays keep away, rushes for an absurd number of yards that Duke never rushes for because they're always throwing the ball. And then after the game, they basically asked Cutcliffe and some of the players, like, what was the thought there? Why were you running so much? And they just said, well, kind of thought that we're playing against an option team. We should try to get more rushing yards than them. And that was it. It worked. They won easily and got more rushing yards than Georgia Tech. Like, wow, that's simple.
I feel like that might be Georgia's plan as well. Just going to go out on a limb there and say that they're not going to have Jake Fromm throw the ball 40 times.
They have proven that if they can get Jake Fromm to just throw like 10 really good passes a game, like go 7 for 10 for, you know, 185 yards, that's cool. You know, they are not going to rethink or overthink this.
Georgia has built the team that Les Miles always wanted at LSU. That's what they've done.
It really was obnoxious. Like that was, I mean, looking back now as with my Missouri glasses on, that was the last of the 5 losses and they've won every game since. But it was just like awe-inspiring. Like every running back they had hurdled a Missouri defender at some point. I think like a tight end or a receiver did too. It was amazing what they were able to do. And then of course they turn around and just completely kind of turned to jelly a little bit against Auburn. I think they will not turn to jelly a second time against Auburn, but that's yet to be seen. Let's see what other. So we've got, I guess that is probably the headliner.
Yes. And I want to thank Georgia for being in this time slot so that people will pay attention to that game instead of Florida State, Florida, or Ohio State, Michigan. If people want to pay attention to that game instead of Florida, Florida State, or Louisville, Kentucky revenge game, or Indiana, Purdue bowl eligibility. Like, there's so many options for you college football fan, other than watching a moribund, unhappy Florida team play a beat up, also probably unhappy for different reasons, Florida State team.
Don't talk about my Wolverines like that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
By the way, that is clearly the biggest game. That was a misstep on my part. No, I mean, really though, for title purposes, that's probably the biggest game, with Ohio State being either 1A or number 2. We know from search traffic which of those games will be bigger, but I mean, yeah, this is a lovely selection, and I do kind of wish that I was going to have a chance to watch East Carolina Memphis, because I think Memphis will do nasty things. But regardless, I'll just catch the highlights of that one. Moving to the, well, first we've got at 12 p.m. we've got more playoffs, and then at 1 p.m. we've got more playoffs. Furman, Elon, New Hampshire hosting CCSU. Central Connecticut.
I was gonna say. Central.
That's a failure on my part. Lehigh at Stony Brook, Samford at Kennesaw State. The fighting Jason Kirk's on it at 1 p.m. on ESPN3.
Plank!
How in the, like, every single time he posts on Twitter now, by the way, with his little new, I just want to respond with hashtag plank every single time. It makes me so happy. And did I see that his daughter made him a plank yesterday?
Yesterday was Jason's birthday, and so wonderful. His daughter made him his own turnover plank, which is amazing.
Just beautiful. 2 p.m. Now, this is just mean. How are you going to have UNLV Nevada on at like 1 or what is Las Vegas Pacific time? Yeah, like noon local time. Yeah. Come on.
It's you're going to get an interesting crowd there. Let's just say that.
If you get a crowd there. 2:30 p.m. Now we get a lot more interesting stuff. Of course, I'm talking about Iowa State Kansas State being on ESPN2 at 2:30. I guess some people might choose Alabama Auburn at 2:30 on CBS. Boise State at Fresno State, where basically they'll just kind of, you know, jab at each other for 60 minutes and not try to give anything away for when they play the next week in the Mountain West title game. North Carolina at North Carolina State, 2:30 p.m. on ESPNU. I like the I never watch, but I like just having the annual reminder of Giovanni Bernard's punt return with like 15 seconds left back in 2012 or 13.
Haven't NC State fans dealt with enough lately? Do we really got to rip their hearts again like this?
I do, by the way. They did clinch not winning 10 games for another year.
Yet again.
It is a staggering, but the amount, and this is going to sound like rubbing it in. This is the stuff I admire as a Missouri fan. They have won more than 9 games once in their history. And they have had, like, if you list out their best players, awesome list.
It's a murderer's row. It's like on par with SEC teams, certain Pac-12 teams, Big 12. Like, you look and it's not like they're just getting by with, you know, JUCO guys or 2 stars, right, or what. It's like legitimately super talented dudes.
0 top 10 finishes ever. I speak with admiration. It is just one of the most awe-inspiring things. But with the loss to Wake Forest last week, they are 7-4. If they win out, they will be 9-4, and they will yet again not have hit the 10-win mark. That's commitment is what it is. Penn State at Maryland, 2:30 on BTN. Regional rivalry. Wisconsin at Minnesota, 2:30 on ABC. West Virginia at Oklahoma, 2:45 on ESPN, where I guess Baker Mayfield will.
He will be very sorry, Bill. He will be deeply, deeply sorry for his actions, which heartily offended those of us who watch the sport where somebody could suffer grievous injury at any moment.
Well, again, according to ESPN, he whipped something out in the middle of the game. That cannot be. I do kind of wish now that we had like a captain's armband, like in soccer, where, you know, they could show it all game. Off. Right, they'd show it all game on like the left tackle instead of Mayfield, and have mm-hmm. that as the visual reminder of everything that Baker Mayfield did wrong.
The shame is brought.
Michigan State at Rutgers, 3 p.m. on Fox. Northwestern at Illinois, 3 p.m. on FS1. And then another round of FCS playoff games. South Dakota at Nichols. Screw you, Nichols, for getting in instead of Austin Peay. And Western Illinois at Weber State. Oh, baby. Temple at Tulsa, 3 p.m. on ESPN News. That is not an FCS game. Vanderbilt at Tennessee, also not an FCS game. 3 p.m. on SEC Network. Arizona at Arizona State on Pac-12, so nobody will see it. Grambling versus Southern, Bayou Classic. Man, I wish I had a reason to go to that every year. It lives up to all hype. That is the last game of the afternoon session, though. So I'll before I start going into how the Southern band like brought a tear to my eye with Purple Rain, we'll move back to the games.
Where do you want to start?
How about the Iron Bowl? I hear that's a relatively big game that people seem to care about.
Yeah, yeah. It's really hard to tell if we're doing the same thing we've done so many years in the past, where we talk ourselves into reasons for Team X to beat Alabama, because we want Team X to beat Alabama, not because we necessarily dislike the Crimson Tide or think that they're overrated or whatever, but just because in the interest of variety and the chaos that drives our sport, we need to cling to that belief. I can't decide, you know, looking back, there are definitely games Auburn played this year where you're like, if you couldn't hold that lead against LSU,
right,
how are you going to beat Alabama? But on the flip side, if you are able to dominate Georgia the right way that you did, maybe that is how you beat Alabama. I think the biggest problem, though, is like leaning too much on the Georgia game for evidence that Auburn can beat Bama, and I'm not saying they can't, is the quarterback difference. I mean, that right was the game where we saw, oh, yeah, Georgia's got a young, inexperienced right quarterback who is not ready to win a game if you put it all on his shoulders. Jalen Hurts at least has shown that he can do that. That's what happened in the Mississippi State game.
I love that Jalen Hurts is not – he's got as many as, what, one, two, three, four more games. He's already started, 26 games or 20 – yeah, 26 games in his career. Just obnoxious game totals at this point for when you play 15 a season, I guess. But, from a matchups perspective, I can absolutely talk myself into this being a really tricky game. And the preview piece I wrote yesterday talked about how, you know, Alabama is really the one major statistical weakness they have is that Jalen Hurts takes a lot of sacks. Well, guess who's really good at sacking the quarterback? Yeah. And on standard downs, even not just in like blitz situations, but they're really good at saying, oh, you're passing and getting to the quarterback really quickly. And so Alabama's run game is good, but not amazing. They do require Hurts to still run 8, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 times a game. And he better do it well, because the running backs are good as a whole, but there are a lot of 2-yard runs in there. And that matchup alone could flip the game. If Alabama's going 3 and out for a while and the crowd really gets into it, it's really not hard to see Auburn landing at least a couple of shots offensively and getting, you know, posting a score that makes the game winnable. So, yeah, it's one of those, like, I can legitimately say I think Auburn has a very good chance, but if Alabama's up 24-0 after 8 minutes, it's not going to be surprising to anybody at all. You know they've got it in them to do it. They haven't done it quite as much, at least since they ate Vanderbilt's soul and then beat Ole Miss quite rudely. They really haven't really ever had to hit that fifth gear again. And, you know, I guess when you haven't done it for a while, you might forget how.
Yeah, I mean, for Auburn, to me, it feels like they don't have to score a crazy amount of points. I mean, just looking at the history of teams that beat Auburn, you really only need to score like 25, 28 points. It's a surprisingly low number that the teams that have beaten Bama in the last, you know, 7, 8 years have needed to get. The problem is you have to sort of have productive drives. And by that, I just mean like keeping field position in your favor, getting enough time off the clock so that your defense stays rested and their defense gets taxed, especially with an Alabama team that doesn't have, because of injuries in part, the defensive depth at all layers that we've seen in the past. I think that was what I liked about the Georgia game was, you think back on it, Auburn comes out, they look competent on defense, but they didn't look dominating. They finished with field goals on their first two drives. And at first you say, well, that's how you lose a game.
That's what I was saying.
Right. But what was important was that a field goal is a hell of a lot better than a 3 and out. A 9-play drive that takes up 3.5 minutes is way better than a 3-play drive that takes up 18 seconds.
And really, I mean, it is also just about whatever it takes to stay close for as long as possible and make Alabama nervous, especially in a place where every time they lose, the upset gets named.
Right.
And the crowd really does, I think, start to take over those situations. But yeah, I mean, if Alabama is the team going 3 and out in the first quarter, and even if Auburn's just getting like a first down or two and then punting for a while, yeah, you get that field position and you just get that cumulative effect of the crowd knowing they have a chance here. That's a really dangerous situation for Alabama to be in. And obviously Nick Saban knows that very well. I always pick Alabama and I'm almost always right. But Auburn, it really does seem like there's at least a pathway for Auburn here.
They're going to do something tricky too. I don't know what it's going to be. Might be on special teams, might be on a fourth down conversion, whatever. But Auburn will at some point, because I think you kind of have to against Alabama. At some point, you have to try to shoot the moon. You just do. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, you'll probably lose.
They better, because I don't sign up for boring Auburn.
That's what Mississippi State refused to do in the fourth quarter of that game. Was they refused to just say, you know what, we're going all in.
Yeah, it seemed like they thought, oh no, we can win this just running the ball and going 3 and out and making stops. We're fine.
God, you got big blinded to death, Mississippi State.
those early points made them believe a little too much.
Yeah.
Our friend Matthew Kennerly, Matt_FS on Twitter asks, what do you make of the fact that Fresno State and Boise State will play 2 straight weeks, and how would S&P Plus account for the probability of resting starters for the title game? S&P does not account for that at all. S&P doesn't account for injuries either. If there were reliable injury data for all teams, and if I was able to put in enough time to figure things out in that regard, great. But yeah, it's just not. It's going to see the result as a viable result. And I guess technically, the team that wins has a much better. It's a really weird computer, weird system they have going for determining home field in that game. But technically, Boise still has a lot of reason to put together the plays to win this game, so that they get to play on the blue field in the title game. So. I would assume they're putting enough real effort forth that the fact that S&P will treat it as a real game is okay.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, if you're Fresno State, you also want to win that game because you don't want – let me put it this way. If you're Boise State and you lose that game, do you go back home or do you just say, you know what, extend the hotels, might as well stick around? Get the points is what I'm saying. Get those points.
I personally came to appreciate downtown Boise. So if I were a Boise coach, I would want to go back to drink at some of the bars I found there. But that's not at all applicable. I just wanted to give a shout out to downtown Boise, because that's what people do.
That is very on brand for this podcast.
West Virginia at Oklahoma is obviously another. Well, I mean, among other things, West Virginia is crazy enough to win that game. If there's any sort of funk, that Oklahoma suffers. And we've seen with Owen Field over the last few years, that place rises to the occasion. Great. But if they're in the middle of like an upset bid, no place in the country clams up quite like Owen Field, I think. And West Virginia might have another dose of crazy left then in them to make things kind of weird here. But, then again, Oklahoma's backup quarterback is a former 5-star who's going to be awesome next year.
I
just talked myself right out of that one.
Must be nice. Who's the best team West Virginia's beaten this year?
Beaten? I think their best games have all been like tight losses. Right.
Like they beat Iowa State. They knocked them off. And other than that, it's like, I don't know. It feels like a little bit of a stretch to say that Oklahoma has to look out too much for this West Virginia team. This team, like, look, they play teams close. Yeah. Virginia Tech, TCU, both single score losses.
OSU was close. I don't remember how that game played out exactly, but it was at least in doubt to some degree for a while.
Right. That said, they beat Baylor by 2. They beat Kansas State by 5. Even Iowa State, you know, good team, beat them by 4. So I don't know. It doesn't necessarily feel like in most situations they are consistently able to find the offense necessary to win these games.
Yeah, and the other side of that is I do find myself trusting Oklahoma at this point. The only real reason that I'm not kind of penciling them into the playoff is they do, no matter how much I personally trust them, they have to beat Gary Patterson twice.
Right.
And that seems like a pretty big deal. Plus, I mean, let's be honest, the victory lap we will take if in the first year of the Big 12 title game, the Big 12 title game keeps a Big 12 team out of the playoff. It will be glorious, and
it will be
both mad and very happy to take that victory lap.
That's the ultimate college football experience.
That's true. You pound your chest while being really angry at the same time. Evening slate. After Grambling Southern ends, you got to at least watch the halftime show. Then you can flip over at 6 o'clock to Oregon at State at Oregon on ESPN2. That wasn't a threat. You actually could do that. Prairie View at Texas Southern for why the hell are they? Oh, that was a storm delayed game from September. Clemson at South Carolina, 6:30 p.m. on ESPN. Texas A&M at 6:30 on SEC Network. Texas A&M LSU. UTSA at Louisiana Tech, 6:30 on ESPNU. Notre Dame at Stanford, 7 p.m. on ABC. San Diego at Northern Arizona at 7 p.m. Washington State at Washington, getting the primetime Fox treatment. Wazoo with a chance to go to the Pac-12 title game. If they can win in Seattle, I still don't really think they can, but we'll see. BYU at Hawaii, the Lost Luster Bowl, 8 p.m. CBS Sports. Colorado, Utah, 9 p.m. on Fox Sports 1. Speaking of rivalries that only produce tight finishes, every single one of the games they've played since joining the Pac-12 have been decided by 7 points or less. Utah State at Air Force, bringing up the rear, 9:15 p.m. on ESPN2.
It's a mix. It's a lot of games that I would like to be a little better or a little more impactful, I guess, than they are. Like Notre Dame, Stanford, you know, realistically Notre Dame is out of the playoff at this point. Stanford, whether, you know, might win the Pac-12 North by default, depending on Apple Cup, but they're not really going to challenge for anything as well. Apple Cup is the same thing. There is maybe some very winding path through which I talked myself out of it immediately. Neither one of these teams is going to get in. There will be fun football to watch. The only thing you're potentially watching for in some of these games is this going to be getting somebody fired? And by that I mean Texas A&M and LSU.
Yeah, you know, now the new rumors are that he's probably fired regardless, which, you know.
But how many times have we heard that happen, and then you go out and you beat this team that is ranked higher than you, that people think you're not supposed to beat, you beat them on the – you know, if he goes out, if Kevin Sumlin takes the Aggies, beats LSU by 18 points, I can already read the articles from the local media and the message boards just being like, well, they figured it out. We're gonna see what happens in the bowl game. They beat somebody there, and it's like, yep, got it figured out. Yeah, it's just I'm not convinced. Listen, Ed Orgeron was definitely fired after the Florida game. He was definitely not going to be coming back. Yep. He sure as hell is the coach of LSU this year.
That's still just the most baffling. And I realized they would have probably taken Tom Herman if he wasn't using them for Texas. So it wasn't automatic, but it was funny. That was Godfrey's on the scene talking about everybody just melting down, saying we just blew it, it's over. And then he gets a contract a week later. That was still one of the oddest. Texas A&M, though, better freaking watch out. Cause I mean, yeah, if the rumors were true that it's a stale marriage. We're just going to move on. That has basically worked out well for one school ever. And that's assuming it ends up working out really well long-term for Kirby Smart at Georgia. Otherwise, if you've got a coach who's capable of winning at Baton Rouge, against an LSU team, not in a situation like last year's LSU team, don't want to bring up McElwain there, but if you've got a good coach who you wish was better, figure out how to make him better. You make a coach and change, you might get Mike Shearman. You don't have to look very far back into Texas A&M's history to realize you can't just say, you know, we're tired of this. Let's find a new good coach to take us to the next level. It's not that easy. It's not even slightly that easy. And A&M should know that as well as anybody. So I'm going to assume you're right. If they beat LSU, he's fine. I can make a very good case that when you have a freaking freshman, true freshman quarterback, and you're in the SEC and you go 7-5, that should be enough too. but
fair. It's fair. I mean, I just logic and reason don't always apply. We both know this.
That much is very clear.
All right, I'm gonna ask you a point blank question.
Okay.
Apple Cup. Are both of those coaches there this time next season?
Washington State is another situation, and like A&M is, you know, the rumors you hear over time, and like, yeah, they might just decide that they're kind of tired of each other and move on. My guess is yes, they are. I mean, Peterson, I mean, where the hell else is he going to go? But Leach, I'm guessing that all the, you know, the harmony there remains and that he stays the coach. It does sound like there's a, you especially if you're covering Mike Leach, you reach a point where you're like, okay, can I start creating some rumors to get another coach moved in? Cause man, am I tired of this. But I assume that everybody, especially if they freaking win the Pac-12 North, they figure out how to keep working together.
Yeah. Peterson's interesting to me because, listen, I don't think he's in trouble at Washington or anything like that, but his name continues to bubble up for open jobs that come open across the country. And before, we used to just always say, he's not leaving Boise State. He's not leaving Boise State. And every year we were right. But now we've seen that, like, he can be convinced to depart. And what, you know, whether we fully understand why he left Boise State and took the Washington job in the first place, if some of it was that he felt he was bumping up against a ceiling at Boise, mm-hmm. that could not, like, beyond that, there were things that he just could not reach. It is, in theory, possible that the same thing is going to happen at Washington, right? Like, they're going to say, well, we play in the super tough division, but half the country doesn't even care, right, or notice that it's a super tough division. We have a very challenging recruiting situation where we can get good ones, but getting twos and threes is a lot harder. And I don't know. I don't think it's impossible that we might see Chris Peterson's name get thrown. If the A&M job comes open, mm-hmm. are they crazy to go after Chris Peterson and say, like, here's a truckload of money, also we're in Texas? Is that insane?
Well, if he's married to the Pacific Northwest, then sure. You're in Texas.
Here's a helicopter. You can fly back every day if you want.
Yeah, I think maybe this is something that boils up down the line. I don't see it happening right now. But, okay. I mean, the fact, the ESPN stuff from earlier this year, it did kind of expose something that's not really going to change when it comes to coverage for your team. Yes, maybe they can figure out how to play some better non-conference games. It's not like Boise, where part of their problem was that nobody wanted to. They had an OU series a long time ago. You can arrange good series up in the
sure. North. Oregon's played all right. kinds of non-conference teams. USC managed to UCLA. It's not like being the Pac-12 eliminates you from playing other Power Fives.
And I mean, looking at their future schedules, next year is crap again. Sorry, I was looking at 2017, 2018. They play Auburn in Atlanta, okay. which is news to me. I had no idea that wasn't even slightly on my radar, but September 1st, they play Auburn in the Benz Dome. They've got North Dakota and they've got BYU, which, I mean, anytime you schedule BYU, you expect more than what BYU is currently delivering. But 2019, it's Eastern Washington, Hawaii, and at BYU. But in 2020 and 21, Michigan and at Michigan. So, yeah, I mean, if you get that game, if you have a really good team and you're playing a marquee non-conference game, and then you still get Stanford and a good Oregon, and you know, if Leach is still there, a good Washington State, et cetera, we just complimented Cal. If you survive a good division, you beat Michigan, you win the Pac-12 title game, then you're going to get whatever you have earned. So, yeah, I don't think this is an issue yet, and maybe it won't ever become one. Oh, and they've got Ohio State in 2024 and 25. By the way, buzzkiller of all time, the Missouri-Illinois, you know, they just announced that they're playing again, and that's great. I mean, it's an easy travel, you know, et cetera. It's a fun rivalry in basketball, so it's great. They're playing 26, 27, 28, and 29. Awesome. As my friend pointed out, he's going to be 50 when they play next time. I wish that in my little universe where I'm commissioner, we move the sports information director conference to like February. We expand it by a couple days, and everybody basically sits in a giant like a gymnasium and makes their schedule for the next year. Just wanders around, said who's available, and we schedule, because God, that's not like almost a decade from now. Missouri and Illinois are playing, and we got and that was like an exciting announcement yesterday. Great, we're gonna forget about it for the next 6 years.
Have I ever told you my ludicrous idea that would never work, but I would love it?
Go for it.
I mean, that's kind of vague, but I think we should take 1 week out of the college football schedule, and we should say, like, nobody schedule any games this week. It's not a bye week, but at this point, we're going to let the college football playoff committee say, like, okay, we're going to play, like, not a whole tournament. We're just going to have 1 week, and we're going to start with, you know, we'll go 1 to 24.
Yeah.
One, you're playing 24. Two, you're playing 23.
Back a buster.
Three, yes, exactly. So you have incentive to be highly ranked late in the season, because then you'll get an easier opponent, but you're still getting somebody who's ranked. And if you are number 7, number 10, somebody sort of on the cusp, you're going to play somebody like pretty good. You're going to be able to get the chance to like play somebody pretty tough. I think we tell everybody, throw out one of your non-conference games, the FCS opponent you were going to play, what the stupid game at Jerry World that you were going to have. We're bumping everything up, and we're having this gap week. And that's where we are going to let you, we are going to make it happen. And, you know, the high seed is the gets home field. It's just how it works. It's how everybody knows. And everybody's going to fight about, like, oh, well, we're number 13, but we should have been 9 and blah, blah, blah. But it won't matter, because we'll get one amazing week of college football with nothing but ranked teams playing ranked teams, when it absolutely matters.
The reason you know that this is both a very good and extremely unrealistic idea is I've had a very, very similar idea. My only difference is that you basically do it. You set it up for at least 2 years at a time, where you know you're going to be the home team 1 year and the road team another. So it's kind of like the same deal, except you're playing like you're the number one home team. You'll play the number 12 designated road team or whatever that ends up being.
Right.
Yes.
And it should be that easy. But in reality, college football scheduling is a lot like seating at a wedding, where there's all these stupid politics that you have to sort of account for and be like, well, no, he hates him and she used to date that guy, and these two, you know, both have a gluten allergy, and it's just a huge pain in the ass.
All right, two more questions and then we'll get out of here. Number one, from our friend Derek Klassen at QB Class with a K. I need Ryan to envision a hypothetical. Florida head coach Ken Niumatalolo.
You know what? It's interesting. I at this point, I really just want Florida football to be interesting. The problem with the Will Muschamp and the Jim McElwain years is that it didn't matter. It almost didn't matter the week or the season. I sort of knew what I was going to go out and watch, and I knew that it was going to be kind of tasteless, meaningless, processed football product. And there are a lot of reasons for that, and I'm not here to just like bag on the two head coaches, because I think there are contributing factors. But this would be different. This would give me a reason to like sit up and pay attention and really be fascinated by the school that I went to again. Isn't that the whole point, is to have like some entertainment value? Yeah, it might torpedo the program for the rest of, you know, my life, but I already got to watch him win two national titles as grown person. I'm fine. I'm cool.
No, this is where I wish I had like a little, just an Earth One kind of thing, where I could just go over and like a little sandbox to play in. Like, I really wish, I have no idea if it would work. So it's not that I can just straight up advocate for it, but I want an option guy like Niumatalolo to go to a super high ranking job just to see what happens.
Just to see what. Now, the problem is that we will inevitably create the anti Spurrier, because Steve Spurrier famously comes to Florida because when he's a high schooler in Tennessee, Tennessee is running single wing at that point? and they don't need somebody with his passing skills. So that's why he goes to Florida and continues, and just the rest of his life is tormenting Tennessee, talking shit, making them miserable. So we will inevitably create Tennessee's own Steve Spurrier. And we just have to understand that that will happen, and they will eventually sword fight and one will die.
Just remember that Troy Aikman committed and signed and went to OU to play for Barry Switzer in the 80s. So technically, if the
cocaine was awesome, man, cocaine was so awesome.
If the best passing quarterback in the history of the world goes to a high school in Gainesville, technically, Florida could still sign him. Of course, then he'll break his leg after the offense grows extremely stagnant because in the Switzer case, they moved to like an I formation, but still ran some option, and it was just bad. It just wasn't good at all. And then he gets hurt and they go, whew, and they put in the option quarterback and they win the national title. So, you know,
and then it all works out for UCLA in the end.
Exactly. And then very, very last question. Where'd it go? Oh, so Justin Ferguson, our friend Justin Ferguson at JFergusonAUS, what's the best possible matchup for the Outback Bowl where Ryan will be standing on the sidelines as a proud costumed onion?
Listen, let's not count onion chickens before they onion hatch, before they bloom. I hope that's what happens. I haven't checked the projections recently. I know Michigan LSU is one that's thrown around a lot, and that's probably the one I'm most interested in because you have like two fan bases that will definitely travel and already probably have a decent presence in the Tampa Bay area. you will get like a lot of sloppy quarterback play out of that. You will get a lot of like big heaping running man ball. This will all be happening early on New Year's Day. That is the one that I think would be most enjoyable to me. And it's the one that I don't have like extremely strong emotions either way. I don't hate LSU. I know I'm supposed to after the last 2 years. I don't hate Michigan. I know I'm supposed to because I'm on the internet. But those are the two that I would just be like, yeah, that'd be fun to watch. That'd be sort of good. And it would also, as we sort of alluded to earlier, immediately either add to the panic that Jim Harbaugh is wrong for this job or that Ed Orgeron is wrong for this job. Yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, that's every time LSU loses, I mean, Alabama aside, I guess. It's going to creep back up for like the next 5 years or however long he's in the job. By the way, Jason Kirk's latest Outback projections, Michigan State, Mississippi State.
That one's okay. I feel like that's just sort of like a dollar store version of LSU, yeah. Michigan.
I mean, Mississippi State's better, but Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be that would. You know what? That game might be over in 2 hours, 18 minutes.
All right, Ryan, Annie, I appreciate the time. I have no idea. At some point, Stephen Godfrey will be back. I'm just going to keep trooping right along in his.
When the Angels win the pennant, Stephen's coming home.
I mean, that's like, you know, another 12 months or 10 months away at least. So don't say that. But yes, appreciate the time. We will continue on. I might fly solo on Sunday. I might bring somebody in. I might have Godfrey back. We'll see. We're just all flying by the seat of our pants here. All I know is one thing for sure. Go Blue.